To make any calls you like.
Guess we need to notify.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Today is June 17th. No, it was posted June 17th. Today is June 18th, sorry. And this is a joint meeting of the Senate Committee on Workforce and the House Committee on Business and Labor. So I'm going to call to order the Senate Committee on Workforce for this informational session.
And good morning. I will also open an informational meeting of the House Committee on Business and Labor. And today we'll be talking about policies addressing low wages and self-sufficiency. As you know, this topic's been before us off and on throughout the session. And we have several bills that were introduced to address the minimum wage, which is a piece of this discussion, and also the self-sufficiency and benefits that are available for the working folks with low income. As you know, there's definitely been a lot of talk about the potential for a ballot measure to raise the minimum wage. And we thought it important that the legislature start talking about this issue and try to determine what the future may hold with this in terms of addressing these issues. And whether the legislature will take action on that is remains to be seen. But certainly we feel it's important to have this discussion. So any other opening comments?
Yeah, just to say that, you know, along those lines, we are preparing a work group on the subject of minimum wage. I think we've referenced that before. And that work group is being assembled right now. We're hoping to have our first meeting next week. We want to look at a variety of issues. We just received a new proposal from the speaker, which is in many ways appealing, in many ways intriguing, which takes some of the proposals that are out there and puts them together. But obviously, you know, many of you were part of our public hearings on minimum wage, where we heard from many, many people, and it was really impressed upon us how complicated a subject this is, and you don't raise the minimum wage lightly. And so there are a lot of things that we need to look at, and I'm really excited about us starting this conversation. So stay tuned. I know that you know, a number of you are going to want to be involved in this and will be involved with this discussion. We need you. But we thought that we would start off that process with today's hearing, where we're looking at, you know, some of the sort of deeper implications of the problems that we face, where you know, it's not just a question of how much you make, but what does it take to be self-sufficient, to be able to support yourself and your family. And so to that end, we're really pleased to start off this informational session with Sheila Martin from PSU, who's going to talk to us about what it means to be poor. How do we identify poverty, and going beyond just what a certain abstract number is, what does it mean, what does it take to be self-sufficient in our society today? So Sheila, it's a real pleasure to have you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Dunbrough, Chair Hovey, members of the committee. My name is Sheila Martin. I am the director of the Institute of Portland Metropolitan Studies and the Population Research Center at Portland State University. The Institute convenes regional partners and conducts policy research and curates data to support policy research in the Portland metropolitan region. And the Population Research Center conducts demographic studies, including the generation of population estimates and population forecasts that help you distribute revenue around the state and plan for the future of our state. So today I'm going to talk about how to advance on the slides. I'm going to talk about self-sufficiency. I'm going to talk about an alternative way to assess whether people in our state have enough money to live on. And so I'm going to go over three things. First, what is self-sufficiency? How do we define it? What does it include? I'm going to describe which and how many families in Oregon have enough to get by, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about what it means for families in Oregon. So people throw out a lot of terms like family wage jobs, living wage jobs, and we're not always sure exactly what that means. So the self-sufficiency standard wage is really a benchmark that's been designed in order to give us a good idea of how much money people really need based on where they live and what their family's like in order to support themselves without any public or private additional supports. And really, that depends on what kind of family you're talking about, right? So this family of four has two working adults. Let's suppose they live in Bend. They have an infant and a preschool child. And if we ask the question, how much money does this family need in order to satisfy their basic expenses and live without any help from either the government or from family members, then that would be what we would mean by the self-sufficiency standard. So that's the basic definition. So we build the self-sufficiency standard in the same way that a family would build a budget. We take a look at all of the things that they need to live. We build that into the budget. And this is really a bare bones budget. And some of the assumptions include, since both of the adults work, they both need transportation. The children need full-time daycare until they're in school. And younger school-aged children need after-school care. There's no additional, no frills here. There's no takeout food. There's no restaurant meals. There's no savings, which is, you know, kind of a problem, and no debt repayment. So this really is a bare bones budget. So for this family to live in Bend, it costs them about $63,400 a year. Now, this is a lot of numbers, but what I want to do with this chart is give you an idea of how these costs vary across the state. So if you look at, there's four different family types here and a few different counties that I thought would be of interest to you. And I also distributed a handout that has these numbers for every county in Oregon for eight common family types. But what I want you to notice about this chart is several things. First of all, kids, especially small children that need child care, are very expensive. I had a teacher once tell me, could you please give this presentation in my high school class so that people know what happens to you when you have kids?
I'll give that workshop.
The second thing I want you to take note of is that basic costs vary quite a bit across the state. And third, the federal poverty standard for a family of four, which is about $24,000, for this family doesn't work anywhere in the state. And finally, in most cases, you need two or sometimes three times the federal poverty standard just to make the basic minimum of what you need to live. Now, I want to break that down for you just a little bit more to talk about the assumptions embedded. By the way, this standard is developed by the University of Washington Center for Women's Welfare, and they developed this standard for many states throughout the country, and they developed the standard, and then we use their standard to talk about what's happening in Oregon. So this is their model and their assumptions, but let me just explain what's in here. First of all, for housing, the first assumption is children and adults don't share a bedroom, and no more than two people can be in a single bedroom. So that means that for our family of four, they need a two-bedroom apartment. And the costs for that two-bedroom apartment are based on estimates from the Department of Housing and Urban Development and what they consider a fair market rent. So a fair market rent is the rent at which 40% of those two-bedroom apartments are cheaper than the one I have listed here. So it's considered a decent living condition. So not the most dilapidated, but certainly not a luxurious standard of living. And you know, one of the things that I've noticed in looking at these numbers is that particularly for places where the market's changing quickly, they're probably kind of outdated. So for Multnomah County, a two-bedroom apartment at $889 is not very easy to find if you know anyone who's looked lately. These numbers include utilities, but not phone or cable. And so that varies a great deal around the state, from a low of about $650 in rural parts of the state to in Washington and Multnomah County being close to $1,000. So next, let's look at child care. How do they come up with child care costs? There is an Oregon child market price study done every couple of years, which is required by the federal government. And these numbers are the 75th percentile for child care costs from responses to that market survey. And it's a weighted average of center-based costs, so in a daycare center, and home-based care, which is, in someone's home, they bring in some children. And those costs can be very different. But one of the things that we do know from that study is that over the past decade, child care has increased between 84 and 120%, depending on what kind of care you're talking about. So if it's been a while since you had young children and had to have them in daycare, you might be shocked that for some people, child care actually costs more than their rent, especially if you have more than one child.
Good child.
So the food costs are based on the USDA's low-cost food plan. So again, there's no takeout or fast food or restaurants. It varies by age of children. And if you have teenagers at home like I do, you know that they can eat a lot of food. It's adjusted relative prices throughout the state using Nielsen data on what particular food items cost. The transportation assumptions are pretty interesting. In most parts of the state, the assumption is that both workers need to have a car in order to get to work. And so those transportation costs are based on average commuting distance and the cost per mile of owning and operating a car. It does not include the cost of purchasing a car in the first place. In Multnomah County, because 11 or 12% of workers use public transportation to get to work, they actually assume that low-income people who use public transportation in higher percentages than higher-income people will use public transportation. So that $200 cost there is the cost for those two workers buying an all-fare, all-zone pass on TriMet. So as you can see, the self-sufficiency standard is based on a very different set of assumptions than the federal poverty standard. There are a number of problems with the federal poverty standard. It doesn't reflect changing costs. So originally, it was based on the assumption that most families spent a third of their income on food, and that's simply not true anymore. Most families spend about 13% of their income on food, and other costs have become much more important. It's dated on, the federal poverty standard is also dated on outdated demographic assumptions about the structure of a family and the idea that, you know, one adult in the family could stay home to take care of children. It doesn't vary by location, and it doesn't really track real costs. So those are some of the key problems with the federal poverty standard and how the self-sufficiency standard improves on that. So one of the things that you can imagine, given how low the federal poverty standard is that there are a number of people who aren't meeting the self-sufficiency standard, but they're not officially considered poor. And those are folks that I call stuck in the poverty gap, in the policy gap. Because even though some public supports are at maybe 185%, of the federal poverty standard or 200% of the federal poverty standard, they're still based on an outdated number. And there are a number of people who you wouldn't think of as being poor, but they still are in a constant state of financial crisis because they can't make ends meet, they can't save, and they can't buy large ticket items like the car that I talked about earlier. So now that we know what that means, let's talk about what that looks like in Oregon. So what we did was, taking the numbers that were published by the University of Washington, we take three steps. We take a special data set called from the American Community Survey called the Public Use Microsample. And we sort through these records and we sort people into households. And then we compare their household type with the standard for that household type, and we look at that their income. So if it's a single person living alone, two adults, one child, two adults, two children, the ages of the children, we consider all that, and we compare the income for that household from the census data to the income that's required for self-sufficiency. And then we sort them into three groups: those that are below poverty, those that are above poverty but below the standard, and those that are above the standard. So statewide, 37% of households in Oregon don't make enough to meet the self-sufficiency standard, and 20% fall into this policy gap. They're not poor, but they're not making ends meet. And this, the percentage that fall below the standard vary quite a bit, with from a high of about 44% in Lane County to a low of about 32% in Clackamas and Washington counties. So you might be surprised that there are so many households in our state that are in this condition of financial insecurity. Over time, since 2008, we did this study originally in 2008, and at that time, the percentage statewide was 27%, so it's gone up 10 percentage points. And in some places, there's been higher increases than in other places. So in Multnomah County, it's gone up from 24 to 37%, and Lane County from 32 to 44%. Some cases, like Multnomah and Lane County, the problem has been big increases in costs of housing, of childcare, and so on. And in other places, like in the more rural parts of the state, it's more an issue of stagnant or declining real incomes. So this chart tells us a lot, and so I want to go through how this chart is structured and explain to you what it says to me. On the vertical axis, we have the percentage of people who fall below the self-sufficiency standard. On the horizontal axis, we have different levels of education, and each line represents a different demographic group. So the blue line, white, non-Hispanic males. The dark green line, white, non-Hispanic females. The lighter green line, minority males. And the orange line, minority females. And so this chart, so as you move to the right, people are more educated. And what this chart tells me is that, first of all, for all education levels, households headed by minority females have the most difficult time meeting the self-sufficiency standard. Second, while greater education reduces the percent not meeting the standard, the gap between different demographic groups narrows with education. So we find that for a minority female, making ends meet means having a higher education level than for a white male. And the percent not meeting the standard falls sharply between the point where they have a little bit of college or maybe an associate's degree to when people have achieved a bachelor's degree. So this chart is one that I like to call my myth buster. So it takes a little bit different approach. In each of these columns, what we've done is we've taken all of the households that don't meet the self-sufficiency standard and broken them into groups. So even though people of color are more likely not to meet the self-sufficiency standard, 75% of the households that don't meet the standard are white. 51% of the households that don't meet the standard don't have children, even though having children makes it more likely that you won't meet the standard. 20% of households that don't meet the standard are single mothers, and 17% have a bachelor's degree. So even though we saw that education does improve your ability to make ends meet, not everybody who has a bachelor's degree is able to do that. 17% are not able to. And 94% of people who don't meet the standard also get no cash assistance from the government, and 35% of them own their own homes. So now I want to get back to what all of this means for a typical Oregon family. So let's get back to our family of four with two workers and two small children. Let's suppose that they do live in Bend. The median wage in Deschutes County is about $39,000 a year. They need $63,000 to make ends meet. So what combinations of two careers for these two people could help them do that? Well, if he's a, and I'm using the median wage for these occupations for the workforce area in Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson counties. So that's the median. There are some people who have these occupations that would fall above and some people who would fall below these wages. But if he's a KA teacher and she's a phlebotomist, those are the people who take your blood when you need to get tests done at the doctor. If they're both making the median wage, he's making about $56,000, she's making a little more than $34,000, and they're good. They're making the amount of money that they need to make ends meet and a little bit more to save money for college for their kids and, you know, buy the car that they need to get around. But if he's a tile setter in the construction industry and she's a nursing assistant in the healthcare field, two industries that are growing in Oregon, they're not going to make it. Even though they're both working full-time, making about $58,000 in their combined income, they're not going to make enough to meet their basic needs. The same is true of the couple where one's a full-time retail sales clerk and one's a full-time accounting clerk. They don't have enough money to get by without public or private supports. Now, some people might do things like have an aunt or a grandmother watch their kids instead of putting their kids in a center-based childcare center. They might have an extra room in their home that they rent out, or they might have other ways. They might carpool and reduce their cost of transportation that way. But if we're not considering those kinds of public or private subsidies, then these families, even though they're working full-time, would not be able to meet their basic needs. So the message I want to leave you with is really twofold. First of all, a lot of people, probably more than you expected, even though they might be working full time, are not making enough to make ends meet. And second of all, public and private supports can help close the gap between what they need and what they earn. And I know there's other people who are going to talk with you today about how those kinds of benefits can help. So I'll stop there and just invite questions about the self-sufficiency standard.
Representative Widener.
Mr. Chair. Just going through and looking at the numbers, and it looks like on the one slide you had, we went from 27 to 37% with the increase on, with it being higher in some counties as far as the self-sufficiency standard and everything, mm-hmm. and it's increased since 2008, which we started into a recession at that time. Do you think this could be that we're looking at underemployment, or we've lost some of the industry sectors that provided the higher paying jobs?
I think certainly the period of time over which we were able to collect the data was a recessionary period, and so certainly during those years between 2008 and 2014, there were a number of people who probably had less income either because of unemployment or because of lower stagnating wages.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Senator Jimbrough. Oregon right now, I think, is rated number 45th on the, they're the sixth highest as far as cost of living in Oregon. And when I take a look at some of the salaries just in the city of Portland, and I compare that with average salaries around the state, do you think that perhaps some of the salaries that we're paying in the public entity are affecting that in the private sector to where there is a large disparity? And it seems like it was Portland State. You said you're from Portland State. There was something in the news here a few weeks ago about someone in administration taking a sabbatical, and they were making $600,000+ a year, and there was a kind of an outcry from the public on that. I don't know whether it's Portland State or not, but it was in Portland somewhere. And I'm just thinking, as we do this, and from a business perspective, you know, are we going to be chasing businesses out of Oregon because the cost of living is rising and the ability for them to make a viable product that competes with other states and around the world is going to be a detriment?
I think there are a number of factors that influence whether companies come to Oregon, whether they grow in Oregon, whether they stay in Oregon. Their costs of doing business are an important factor. Their ability to attract the skilled labor that they need is another factor, and cost of living can influence that. There are a number of factors that influence whether people want to live where they live, and that's a very individual choice. I think that some people are attracted to a place because of economic opportunity, and other people are attracted to a place because of other factors. So I'll just...
Okay. I have one follow-up.
Okay, just a quick one.
Yeah. You mentioned childcare, and I think childcare has gone up, increased dramatically in the last few years. And we had some friends that used to be in childcare, but then all of the criteria that they had to meet, got very difficult. And so I'm wondering if some of the mandates from the state on childcare haven't raised the price of childcare to where now it's becoming a little bit difficult for people to make ends meet, or even going through the hoops of starting up a daycare.
I think it's a good question. It's worth looking at why the price of childcare has gone up so much. I'm personally not an expert in understanding the regulatory aspects of childcare, so I wouldn't want to try to guess at that question.
Okay. Thank you, Chairs. The good and the bad of coming before the committee with me on it anyway is I'm a professor at Shemeketa who doesn't make more than $42,000 a year as a public teacher. But I always have lots of questions when folks come forward with studies. So obviously you don't have to do this, but what I would find really interesting is looking at what you have done and comparing Oregon to Minnesota, and here's why. In the early 1990s, the state of Oregon made a choice to limit our tax structure and constrain services, which really pushed our state budgeting in ways we never anticipated. At the same time, around that same time, Minnesota decided to, instead of doing that, they doubled down on education and investment. And right now, they are a magnet for many of the Fortune 500 companies and other companies' headquarters from across the world. I would be really interested to see how that investment that they made roughly at the same time is different than what we made and what the impact is on their relative self-sufficiency costs and opportunities. So if that's a possibility for future study, I would really appreciate that.
That would be interesting, and I believe that the University of Washington has done the standard for the state of Minnesota, and then we could use the same data set that we've used for Oregon for Minnesota to look at that. And, I think that educational attainment, as you've seen, does have an impact on people's ability to make a living. And so, we could take a look at how that has influenced the percentage of their families that meet the self-sufficiency standard.
I would appreciate that if you could help provide that. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Nose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any way to sort of factor in what likely student debt is for folks, right? Like, because we know that that's a real phenomenon that's going on. And so a lot of those people who are educated and have, are also, their income is sort of being, I'm looking for the right word, but they're paying a lot back in loans.
Right. So those 17% of folks with bachelor's degree that aren't meeting the standard, keep in mind the standard doesn't include debt payment. So there's it's possible that number would be even higher, especially for younger people who have recently graduated. I don't want to editorialize, but when I went through my education, I went to a state university, and I think my tuition was $650 a semester. So when I finished, my debt was insignificant compared to what folks are finishing with now.
If I could just follow up on the education issue. I mean, obviously, one of the solutions needs to be to get people more educated and to get them skilled up as much as we can. But there's going to be a lot ongoing need for those lower skilled jobs, right? I mean, people have to do them, whether you're in the city of Portland or anywhere else. So what is the solution for, you know, for those people who are doing very important work for us? I mean, critical work, but it's low-wage work.
I don't know the answer to that, what the solution is. I do know that those are a significant part of the growing part of our economy, are those lower wage jobs along with the higher wage jobs. So there's been a lot of discussion in our state about wage polarization and about the fact that the middle part of the wages, which are some of the jobs that I showed you where two full-time jobs could make ends meet for a family of four, some of those jobs are those that are being lost. So that is an issue that all of you are obviously going to have to struggle with.
So I think I'm going to ask the last question for you, because we need to move on to the next panel. But one of the things that stuck out to me is the federal poverty standard is so out of date. And, you know, when we're looking at a self-sufficiency standard, that gap in between, is there any indication that, because a lot of the programs that help the poor are based on that federal poverty level, so that gap of between that and the self-sufficiency standard, is there any indication that the federal government will ever adjust this to be more real? Are they working on that? Or
yes, actually, there is a supplemental poverty measure that they have recently begun publishing, just to sort of see how it goes. And it does vary with it's adjusted for regional costs of housing, and it makes some other adjustments that address some of the inadequacies of the federal poverty standard, but that the federal poverty standard that's in place is still being used as a benchmark for a number of programs. And I think, you know, it takes a long time. It's going to take a long time for the federal government to decide if and when to change the benchmark to the supplemental poverty measure. And it's still pretty low, even though it provides some variation regionally, and there are some other adjustments that it's still quite low, much lower than the self-sufficiency standard would be.
Thank you very much for your presentation and your work on this. It's informative and something I think we should be paying attention to when we're working on these sorts of policies. So I appreciate your help.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Sheila.
Okay, next up we have a panel of three. Jeremy Rogers, Dave Underreiner, and John Tapania. And they are going to be talking to us about work done by the Oregon Business Council's Poverty Reduction Task Force. And Jeremy, you want to kick it off?
Thank you, Chair Dembo and Chair Holvey. I will actually turn it over to Dave Underreiner, the chair of our task force, to kick things off, and then we'll all share in the presentation, and I'll be running the slides here.
And let me just tell you and for the audience, I'm going to have to leave in a couple of minutes to go do some voting, but so I'll be in and out a little.
Okay, thank you.
Great, thank you. Good morning, Chairs Dembro and Chairs Holvey. We appreciate, and the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Dave Underreiner. I'm the chair of the Poverty Reduction Task Force, part of the Oregon Business Council, also the CEO for Providence Health and Services here in Oregon, and really appreciate the opportunity to share the work that's being done and through the Oregon Business Plan and through the Oregon Business Council, and really in partnership with many others around the whole issue around prosperity, poverty reduction, and thank you for the opportunity and the work that you're doing to really look hard at how we can improve in Oregon. And when we started this work in 2011, the poverty rate was 17%, set a goal by 2020 to reduce poverty to 10%. We're seeing some movement there, and John has done some really good work, and you've seen it, but we're not going to get there by doing little incremental things. And so we We brought a group together. The Northwest Area Foundation helped fund this work and support it. And you can see the task force membership on the slide. Good representation of leadership throughout the state with an active interest in really trying to understand and then help develop short-term and long-term policy and directions around poverty reduction. And I would say that it's a little unique for business to be involved in this kind of work. You don't see this around the country, but really credit to Duncan Weiss, Jeremy, team, and leadership saying business is here to, you know, create jobs, to really support what happens in our state and in our communities. Poverty is an important issue. And part of poverty reduction is job creation. Jobs create dignity. We feel we can play an active role in working with advocates and partners around this effort, as well as helping to create jobs and look at things that help our economy to improve. We engaged Bev Stein with the National Policy Consensus Center at Portland State University, and we have worked with Echo Northwest and John will be talking in a minute, to do a real in-depth analysis of poverty in Oregon and really understand the information, the data, what does this mean? And through that work, developed a white paper called A Path to Prosperity, has served as a foundation for the work that we want to participate in, lead, and support in the state. And John will share some of the work, and it's very important work. Based on that initial research, we've looked at three approaches. One is some on-the-ground pilot projects. So we began working in communities where there were significant opportunities to connect with youth, impoverished Oregonians. And so we're doing some pilot work around skill and opportunity development in Malheur County, Jackson and Josephine County, and with the Clackamas tribes in Chiloquin. And we can talk about that later as time allows. Bev also led a process called a design lab, and we brought folks from around the country together, experts with bringing perspective, creative thought around how would you long-term look at systemic change to reduce poverty, improve prosperity, engage and understand how to work with all sorts of constituencies. Again, across a diverse population, and as you all know, poverty is not defined in one way. I mean, it depends on where you live, urban, rural, diverse kind of populations, whether you're single, whether you have children, you know, all those kind of things and understanding those differences. But bringing these individuals together for 3 days, locked them in a room and said, what would you do different? How would you rethink ways for us to really creatively look at poverty long term? And they developed some very interesting approaches around really bridging the gap from a safety net to higher income stability and so on. And we will share that over time, but it is some very intriguing ways to leverage and work with systems we have now, but rethinking those systems. And the third thing was the legislative agenda and for us to be actively involved in the legislative process, working with our advocates and partners around key changes that we felt would be important in terms of things like removing benefit cliffs and so on. And we prepared an agenda, and it'll be shared here in just a minute, but worked with partners such as Partners for Hunger Free Oregon, Children First for Oregon, and Neighborhood Partnerships, really engaging in how can we collaborate, support, and bring the expertise of business, but really the expertise of folks that understand and are looking to make those kind of changes, certainly the work that you all are doing. So with that, I'd like to really turn it over to John, who will share the work on the path to prosperity. Thank you very much.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I'm John Taponia, president of Echo Northwest, and I'm just going to move through some of the analysis that we did that helped the task force think about strategies and specific policy proposals that, that Jeremy will then describe in more detail. So we'll just move through the work that we did in terms of, you've heard from Sheila before, the federal poverty measure. I have a number of charts here that are going to follow. A lot of that detail was based on 2012 conditions, and so for these charts, we are talking about that more austere federal poverty measure, admittedly outdated, and we can talk about that in more detail later. $23,000 for a family of four, that's now up to about $24,000 in 2015 dollars. We did a projection in advance of this last year's business summit using a method that the Brookings Institution had developed that looked at the correlation between the poverty rate in a state and the unemployment rate. So we took the state's forecast of unemployment rates back in December and rolled that forward into the future. And using the Brookings method, didn't see much of a response with respect to the poverty rate coming down off of the 17% that Dave reported. So the point of this chart was the economy is absolutely important, and getting people to work is critical to bringing down that poverty rate. And at least at the time of the December forecast last year, we didn't have the economy we wanted. At least we weren't forecasting the economy we wanted in order to get the poverty response and bring that down to a goal of 10%. Now the 10% looks like an awful long way to go and a big aspiration, but I will remind you that in 1979, the poverty rate for the state of Oregon was right around 10%. This chart is an awful lot to chew on for this early in the morning, but the point of this and is to break out poverty into its many different dimensions. And so what we did here was take a look at the 640,000 Oregonians who are in poverty on the left-hand side. The little pies break that out into racial detail, racial ethnic detail. But then separating this into adults and kids and illustrating just the diversity of the poor population. So at the top on the adult side, you have about 190,000 or so adults who are not in the labor force. We have elderly, we have people with physical and mental disabilities who are in low-income poverty situations. Moving down, then, you have 171,000 adults who are in the labor force but are poor, the so-called working poor, some of them unemployed, some of them employed, but not enough to bring their families above poverty-level wages. And then you have, you know, a non-trivial 60,000 or so college students who are technically sitting in poverty conditions, and then the kids who are with them. Along the right-hand side of this chart are the number of different state and federal programs that we have in place to address all these different conditions of poverty. But the upshot of this chart is we talk about a war on poverty, and it is a multi-front war. And so as you think about different strategies and different tactics, you need to be thinking about all these different populations and then think about geography overlaying all of these different populations. So that's that was one piece that was helpful. And now to the geographic point, again, overall statewide average at the federal poverty level, about 17%. My characterization of this chart is if you live relatively close to the Columbia River, likelihood is that your rate of poverty is lower, along with Deschutes County. The farther away you get from Deschutes County or the Columbia River, the higher is the likelihood that you're going to be living with neighbors who are in poverty. And then you can see Malheur County almost approaching 23%. Much higher elevated rates for families of color and different ethnic status, Hispanics, American Indian, Alaskan Native, African American, etc., more than a third to 40%. I believe when we did these numbers, if we looked at African American children, 50% of African American children living in the state of Oregon. Living in that, again, remembering Sheila's comment, this is a very austere measure. Spoke a little bit in the previous piece on education, and so now this is we're transitioning a little bit to the challenges that we face as we think about the strategies. This is the chart that I would call the race between education and technology. these are Portland wages by educational attainment level going back to 1940 and through 2010. From 1940 to 1980, Harvard economists would say that the U.S., and in Portland's case, we were educating labor at about the same rate that technology was advancing. 1980 and thereafter, technology was continuing its march, but we were not putting high-skilled labor out at the same rate. That created a big college wage premium for people that could go on and get a master's or bachelor's. We were putting way too many people out into the job market with less than a high school diploma or a high school diploma, and too much supply and too little demand puts downward pressure on wages. So that collapsing job market for lower skilled workers in a time when the economy was demanding more skill has been challenging. Just to reiterate that point, here are able-bodied adults in Oregon by college or educational attainment level, almost 35% or 35% poverty rate for Oregon adults who have less than a high school diploma. And then the one other sort of analytic challenge, policy challenge that we advanced in some of that initial work is this notion of a benefits cliff. And that is the notion that as you are moving out of poverty, off of welfare programs and into work, you do have the inevitability of benefits being taken away and taxes eventually increasing. The problem that we have is that we have many different programs. You have many different committees, some in the House and the Senate, to deal with these programs. But it is not always the case, and then you have the federal government as well, not always the case that we sit down and think about all how those programs all work in concert with one another. And so what this is showing is that as a family is trying to move from, say, you know, $25,000 a year to $40,000 a year, you can have the food stamps declining, child care subsidies disappearing, earned income tax credits starting to phase out, the state income tax starting to increase, et cetera. And as you make a move, you can have an effective tax rate of close to 80% if you're participating on the programs that we're talking there at the top. So those were the challenges that we laid out, and the task force got together, looked at all those challenges, and sat down and thought through some policy responses, in particular for this legislative session. Jeremy, I'll turn it over to you to sort of describe what they came up with.
Great. Thank you. Again, Jeremy Rogers. I'm the Vice President of the Oregon Business Council and also the Director of the Oregon Business Plan, which is a collaborative effort that we staff, but it involves many other business and economic development organizations and business leaders. So I'll start off by saying that, this is a long-term effort. And so I'll talk a little bit about some of the agenda items that we're working on now, but recognizing that, we're obviously not going to solve this problem in this legislative session. But I first just want to put a context around this. The task force is looking deeply and working with partners on opportunities to smooth out the benefits cliff, to improve the safety net and services that we provide for low-income families. But we're also, as we have been for a long time at the Oregon Business Council and through the Oregon Business Plan, focused on a robust education agenda and a robust economic development agenda, because we see this as a holistic set of solutions where we need to build an economy with pathways and support the industries in the state that do pay good wages, supporting our manufacturing industries, our high-tech industries, our food and beverage, footwear, apparel, wood products, clean tech. We have a lot to work with in terms of industries that have a comparative advantage in Oregon and that can continue to grow if with the right supportive policies and that do pay good wages. and supporting the infrastructure for the economy, and particularly focusing on rural Oregon's economy and finding opportunities, which are before this legislature and different committees, to utilize our natural resources in ways that are both sustainable and provide economic opportunity for rural Oregon. So the economic development piece is a huge component, and then the education piece, the effort that the state is has undertaken to really focus in on the key, you know, touch points at along the education continuum around kindergarten readiness and third grade reading, high school and college completion, and then connecting education to careers is a critical part of the strategy. This session, we've been really focused on that last piece, and a broad coalition has come together, and in different committees of this legislature is moving forward an agenda around career and technical education and STEM education to really boost our support for those efforts. Oregon is a laggard compared to other states in terms of our investments in career and technical education. If you look at to the north, the Washington State, you know, they invest 10 to 20 times as much as we do in career and technical education. But I'm not going to get into the details on the economic development and education side because we don't have time for that, and that's many committees for that. But I would like to shift to the third piece of this, which is what we're calling make the safety net work and make work pay. And I'll just give a brief overview, and then I'll let John and Dave chime in, who've been working on these things individually. And many of you have probably touched some of these efforts in different committees, and many of these will be coming for you for votes soon. But the legislative agenda that we've been working on this session includes the reinvestment and redesign of TANF, temporary need assistance for needy families, the primary kind of cash assistance program that we have, and taking the opportunity of reduced caseloads and reinvesting that money into improving the program in terms of smoothing out the benefits cliff by adjusting the income limits, by working more to engage community partners and supporting folks on the TANF program, to support caseworkers, and just really take the opportunity of caseload reductions and put it back in the areas that are most needed to help people transition to work. The related to that is expanding access to employment-related daycare. And again, that's something that will be hopefully before you for the whole chambers for a vote soon. We have a agenda around the tax credits, and we've been working with the tax credits committee and other committees on this. One opportunity is to expand the that we've been focused on is expanding the earned income tax credit, particularly for families with young children. John can talk more about this, but the research suggests that supercharging the earned income tax credit for families with very young children is one of the most effective policy tools that we can use. And also on the child independent care credits, you've probably heard about the Kinney-Geyer plan, which was a merger of a state tax credit and a federal tax credit, excuse me, to create a kind of more effective child care and dependent care tax credit that is, again, hopefully going to be before you soon. So we've been working with many partners on that. The Individual Development Account program, which is a very innovative and important tool that helps people save and invest in their future, which is also a tax credit. And something where Dave has a lot of expertise is better integrating mental health into the CCO model, which is an important opportunity to help that population. A couple things that aren't on here that were also part of that legislative agenda. There's a bill, Senate Bill 890, which was really around creating a better definition and measures of poverty and prosperity in Oregon. I think Sheila's tool, the self-sufficiency standard, could be a critical piece of that, but I think we all have recognized today and have known for a long time that the federal poverty level is not an effective measure. I'm not sure if that bill is going to move forward. It would create a task force, but that's an area that we'd like to work on with you in the future. And another area where we have been working, and there was some investments proposed originally in the governor's budget, but not sure if they're going to move forward either, is really beefing up our investments in the kind of community-based problem solving that we have been really getting good at in Oregon. The CCOs, regional solutions, early learning hubs, STEM hubs, we've been doing a lot of work recognizing that problems are best solved multidisciplinary, involving the community, involving business, involving education at all levels to help move people out of poverty. And opportunities to fuse those efforts together, the healthcare, the education, regional, I'm not sure if I mentioned regional solutions, but the economic development pieces, and really have community-based strategies targeting the populations that need it most. Earlier you saw on Dave's slide some of these pilot projects. We were very instrumental in the early stages of the Malheur Poverty to Prosperity Initiative, which a key element of that was the business community working with the high school, K-12 districts, and the community college to create career and technical education programs that identify the students who are in poverty and least likely to graduate from high school in their freshman and sophomore years, give them an opportunity to be in a career and technical education program that allows them to either do a welding and fabrication track, an allied health services track, and I think they're adding a third track now. And by the time they graduate, both have their high school diploma and a certificate that has meaning in the workplace, so that they can immediately begin working or use that for to get to community college and higher education. And so doing more of these types of things is important, and that requires some additional investment. But I'll stop there and see if these guys have more to add on any of these pieces.
And I think at this point we would like to open it up for some questions because your time is nearly exhausted, and we have some other panelists, and I do think it's important that we get a chance to ask some questions. And I've got a couple myself, but Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I appreciate that presentation and the positive spin, and I think sometimes I think we've gotten run over so hard this legislative session, you know, by the I think some anti-business bills that have come out that we have a little bit of road rash on us. But I do think we all would like to see the wages increase in Oregon. We would love to see Oregon become greater in prosperity, and I appreciate your approach. One of the things that I did want to mention, because I haven't really heard anyone talk much on it this session, is we have an issue right now where we do have high unemployment, and yet like Boise Cascade over in our area would like to start another shift at their plywood plant, but they can't find the people with the right character quality to do that. And so it's not necessarily, we hear a lot on education, and I wouldn't disagree with that, but it seems like some of the people that we have coming out now into the workforce lack the character to make companies want to hire them. And so I don't know if you've addressed that or not.
Thank you, Representative Barreto, Senator Denbro, Senator Holvey. It's what we refer to as the soft skills, and you know, when you do talk to employers across the state, you hear that as a key barrier. You know, we don't have anything in this agenda to address that. I think it's a difficult problem to get at. Dave might have some thoughts as a major employer in the region about that are more sophisticated than mine. But we hear it everywhere, and it does need to be addressed.
I will take the opportunity to put another plug in for career technical education because students who come out of those programs really are ready to work, and it is, you know, I think another benefit of them. It's not just the hard skills, it's the soft skills.
Yeah, and I think I appreciate that, and I do think a lot of organizations do appreciate the soft skills, but at least having a core set of abilities, whether it's coming out of a, you know, a CTE program, which would have a defined skill set, or we invest in helping folks to develop the skills we need in the organization, but they've got to have a minimum, you know, training or education or someone that we can work from. And we do try to collaborate and partner with universities, community colleges, and others around the needs that we do have, and then hopefully they structure their training and support and education around really positioning those students to become active in the workforce. So it's a combination of a lot of things, but I would agree with Jeremy, a lot more work to be done there.
Okay, Rep Nose, then Rep Wyman.
I want to thank you for bringing your presentation. I saw a lot in there that I actually agreed with and saw a lot of alignment with a lot of things that my side of the aisle cares about. I'm curious about, has your organizations, as you guys looked at this agenda and the things you put forward, have you thought about how we might find the financial resources in the state to pay for it? Because I think a lot of the things that you put up there on the slides require investment.
Sure. Representative Nuss, Chair Denborough, Chair Holvey, the best way to do that is through continued economic growth. I mean, if you look at the resources and the trend of resources becoming available based on the economy growing, keeping that up by far is going to be the best thing that we can do to allow ourselves to continue to invest. And a lot of the stuff that we're talking about here, if we do these investments, they're reinforcing and they bring new resources into the general fund. But you know, the state is facing a very significant problem coming up. You look at next biennium, we've got the PERS decision, you've got Medicaid subsidies going away, you've got the Cadillac tax. I mean, there are significant pressures facing the budget. So I think, looking at a comprehensive solution moving forward around how do we continue the economic growth, how do we address some of those budget challenges so we can invest in these things that matter, and how do we, if needed, how do we make sure we have any additional revenue that can support that. So, this session, we're giving back a kicker. Our organization's always been interested in talking about how to, do tax reform in the state, including, modifying the kicker, which is not the smartest policy. There's a reason why we're the only state that has it. But there's other things, too, and I think it's going to take a comprehensive approach, including looking at revenue.
Okay, Rep. Wyman.
Actually, I think if you go to slide 6, it would address Representative Nose's question, because when people are working, you don't have poverty issues. I mean, that's what it comes down to. So,
but you got to make investments, right? And like, it's a reciprocal cycle. It's
one at a time.
So, my question is, because the cost of living is high in Oregon, so we're one of the tops for cost of living. And we're looking at increasing the minimum wage. And we had a professor who testified before us earlier this session from Berkeley that said the cost would go up 7% roughly by going to $15 or $13 an hour minimum wage at that point. And I just kind of put some of the numbers together off of one of the presentations that we just had earlier and everything and what that would do. We have a lot of people, senior citizens and everything, on a fixed income. And these senior citizens, they can't adjust their income. So when we're looking at making changes like this, large corporations usually can adjust because they're already at that level. I'm just wondering about the detrimental effect that this is going to have on small businesses, the mom and pop businesses, where they have one or two employees that they're paying $10 an hour, they're hiring a high school kid to come in. How do you see that affecting the state across the board? I didn't really see anything adjusting that, and I didn't see us looking at senior citizens in your presentation, what it's going to do to them as far as throwing them into the poverty system, because we're going to drive the cost of goods up if we implement an increased minimum wage. So, and these are the people I'm concerned about, so I don't see it necessarily being helpful for the poor, the senior citizens, and I see the middle class kind of getting hurt, because as a business owner, I think one of you has a business, you find the middle wage, these guys don't get their salary increases because these guys got bumped up, so now you're having to freeze salaries, and is what we do, rather than having somebody making $25, when they come up, you're going to have more people running around the $20 an hour range rather than the
John, do
10
you
to 25.
Want to address that?
Sure. I thought I was going to get through this session without commenting on this, but here we go. If you want to start a fight in the Echo Northwest lunchroom, you bring up the topic of the minimum wage. There are a lot of topics that economists will agree on. This is not one of them. I would say the most thoughtful piece that I have come across as I've thought about directions on the minimum wage came out of the Brookings Institution last year, the Hamilton Project. Professor from University of Massachusetts Amherst is considered a thoughtful national commentator on this. So I would direct you to that piece. His benchmark is half the median. That's roughly statewide where Oregon is now. As you push past half the median, you're experimenting in places that the U.S.
What do you mean by that, John? Half the median?
Half of the median wage in a region or in the state. And that's where, since Oregon raised its wage back up to the current, you know, the levels now that are higher than the federal, that's roughly been where we have been. Seattle, Los Angeles, et cetera, are pushing toward 60% of the median. And economists are essentially standing back and saying, let's see what happens. I mean, let's see what happens.
Let's see what happens.
Mike, let me follow up on that.
Actually, I think the chair.
Yeah, we really need to keep moving, and your question was pretty long, so I wanted to get to a couple other people, including myself. So, I mean, you bring up an interesting piece, which is one of the things I didn't hear a lot, was the topic of raising the minimum wage to help address this. I mean, I note that, you know, the difference between your charts using poverty probably do correlate to some degree to Sheila Martin's presentation on self-sufficiency, but there are definitely two different models where the benefit cliff is a big issue, and I think mm-hmm. you're right to look at that, right to address that, it seems like even some of our assumptions that this is a rural-urban issue are kind of blown out of the water with these charts, where you look at Lane County, who's relatively urban, and I'd like to see the educational levels of different counties as well, and I would assume probably a higher education level, yet it's one of the higher states or higher counties for poverty and self-sufficiency problems. And so, and granted, a lot of your programs, as Representative Noes points out, are really, you know, challenges for general fund dollars, whether it's education, which Lane County kind of shows that maybe it's not all education's a problem, but so I just, in tax credits, you know, again, a general fund type of issue, and those tax credits really are like one time a year, and, you know, how do you help the family that needs that regular income in this gap between our established poverty level and this self-sufficiency level? And that's the gap that's causing the problem, you know, for us, you know, as a state trying to get people out of what I would consider poverty, not having a minimum wage that provides a living wage, which I think is historically what the minimum wage was established for. And so it's interesting that, you know, you haven't really focused on that, except that it's controversial. You don't have an opinion one way or the other about whether that's the direction we should be looking at. And I fear that the state will, and the people of the state, through an initiative process, will be looking at it. And if we don't get in the conversation, it will be driven from, from the public, which may be good or bad. I don't know. So can you help me with why the discussion of minimum wage is not the answer? I understand economic growth is important, does help, a big issue, but I think historically that we've had good times and bad times of economic growth, and this problem doesn't go away in either scenario. It still exists. The jobs I think we're creating, statistics will show, are lower wage jobs as opposed to the past. Our manufacturing base, the wages haven't kept pace, you know, since 1980. You know, so how do we address this wage piece of this?
Right. So I will clarify that I do have an opinion, and my opinion, looking at the literature on the minimum wage and the commentaries up to this point, is that Oregon is
closer to the right answer than the United States as a whole and then most states now. If it ventures closer, if it comes off of this 50% of the median where it is today and moves higher, it's tempting fate in terms of potential job losses. Automation cut hours are the increased likelihood as you move closer and closer to that median. I think the other piece is that, I mean, think of places like Ontario. We'll just take the $13 that has been uttered. If $13 is something that Seattle is sort of moving through and toward, how does that compare to then Ontario attempting to sort of move into that space, or fossil Oregon moving into that space? So that's a challenge. I would say that if you have a couple of tools right now, the state has already used the minimum wage tool much more effectively than most other states have. There may be a little bit more that could be done with that, but I don't know how much more. The tool that I would want to use would be the earned income tax credit. And I understand there's a revenue challenge with that, but it is a far more targeted piece. And I think, you know, if we want to come back 25, 30 years from now, I will tell you both at the federal level and at the state level, I think you'll see a huge expansion in the federal, in the earned tax credit over time. That is the future of social policy.
Great. Well, I'm going to let you have the last word on that, and I appreciate you coming down. I appreciate all the work you guys have put into this as well. This is, you know, it's really a lot of good information. I hope we can continue this conversation and use some of this information and work collaboratively towards some solutions. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and bring up the next panel. Next, Tamara Brickman and Claire Clark.
And I think with this panel, we're going to be digging more deeply into this question of the benefits cliff and what it is and perhaps how it can be avoided.
Chair Dambro, Chair Holby, for the record, my name is Tamara Brickman. I'm with the Chief Financial Office at the Department of Administrative Services, and I'm a policy and budget analyst. And I have Claire Clark, who's a lead research analyst at the Department of Human Services, and Eric Moore, who is the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Human Services. And we wanted to talk to you a little bit about a very small study that we did with a group of individuals kind of looking at the impacts of the rise in wages on individuals' benefits. And we didn't necessarily focus on just minimum wage issues. We were focusing on either increased number of hours worked or as people move through the wage scale and get higher paying jobs. We initially formed a group that involved a number of agencies, including two branches of government that had representatives from the Chief Financial Office, the Legislative Fiscal Office, the Legislative Revenue Office, the Department of Human Services, Oregon Health Authority, the Department of Consumer and Business Services with the Health Insurance Exchange because of the ACA tax credit issues, and the Office of Economic Analysis. And we got together for the purpose of having a discussion in light of conversations that were taking place inside and outside of the Capitol around the increased earnings and the potential impacts on individuals who receive benefits and or tax credits in Oregon. And again, not just related to increases in minimum wage, but also as people progress through the wage scale and or increase the number of hours worked. And then also the conversation was informative and with respect to the Department of Human Services and looking at some TANF redesign issues. And you'll have to remind me if I am speaking in acronyms and need to be less acronym friendly, then I will try to do that.
We'll do it.
This was a very limited study and scope with respect to what we looked at. We looked at benefits and tax credits, and as you can see, I'm not going to read through all the list because you can read as well as I can, the different benefits that we looked at that could potentially be impacted on an increase in wages. And in order to basically complete the study in a timely fashion during the session and also for our purposes of doing some policy analysis, we had to make some assumptions about the household types that we would be looking at with respect to those types of households that receive benefits in the state of Oregon. And we focused on three household types, and that's a single adult with no children, one parent, adult parent families with one child, and one adult parent families with two children. And the primary reason we focused on those groups is they make up the vast majority of the types of households that are receiving benefits through DHS, primarily the SNAP, TANF, and or ERDC or employment-related daycare programs. We also then wanted to kind of further refine some characteristics of those households and focused on certain age groups, particularly the adults. The assumption is that we were working with 30-year-old adults and children between the ages of 3 and 6, and the reason we focused on those is because a 30-year-old is the most common age for a head of household in a low-income household with a child that's 5 years old. And then the children, focusing on children between 3 and 6 years of age, is because that is the largest or the most common age grouping of children who are receiving benefits under the employment-related daycare program. We also then took a look at the households that we were talking about in two different areas of the state, one in the metropolitan area, focusing on Portland, and also wanted to look at a rural community. And we focused in this case on Burns in eastern Oregon, Harney County. And the reason for the differentiation between those two communities is that Portland has the highest number of minimum wage jobs, whereas several counties in eastern Oregon, and we just picked Harney County out of the eastern Oregon counties, have the highest percentage of workers earning minimum wage. So that's why we chose those areas. And then we looked at the two different types of workers, part-time workers and close to full-time workers. And the assumptions made here with respect to why we focused on 18 hours a week and 30 hours a week is because with 18 hours a week, that is the average number of hours an individual making minimum wage up to $11.99 an hour works. And then 30 hours a week is the approximate amount, is approximately the amount of half of the workers who make more than $13 an hour work. Is on a, they work the half of that population work 30 hours or more. And so I'm going to turn this over to Claire and Eric to have a conversation about the data that we look that we found with respect to how these the increase in wages can have an impact on certain types of benefits individuals receive. So Claire, I'll have you go for it.
All right. So I know we've seen a lot of charts this morning, and I'm going to go through several more charts, but they're all quite similar and they're structured in the same way. And so these charts are gonna show how as your income increases, how your receipt of benefits and tax credits changes in tandem. So first I'm gonna talk about single adults with no children, then I'll cover one parent, one child families, and then in the interest of time, I've left off the data for one parent, two child families, but that data is available. And then I'd also like to point out that because such a few number of people are actually served by the TANF or the employment-related daycare programs, I've pulled those programs out and I will look at them separately. So this first series of charts that I'll show you don't include those programs, and then I'll point out when I've started incorporating those programs. And then also, as Tamara mentioned, we did look at rural Oregon. The majority of these charts will be for Portland because the differences are really very negligible in terms of your receipt of benefits because they're mostly based on your income level. But I will show a rural Oregon slide for the employment-related daycare because you do see an impact in benefits received for that program depending on where you live. So to orient you to this chart, if I can draw your attention to the horizontal axis, you'll see that there's two numbers there. So there's the hourly wage at the bottom. I've started at $9.10 an hour because that was the minimum wage in 2014. And all the data and eligibility requirements we've used for this study were the 2014 data and standards. So you have the wage on the bottom. It's increasing by 50 cents. And then the monthly income above that. So looking at a single adult in Portland working 18 hours a week, you can see the impact on their benefits mainly in terms of their eligibility for Medicaid. So at $17 per hour, they become ineligible for Medicaid. We assume that they go to the private health insurance exchange. They purchase health insurance. At this point, they receive the advanced premium tax credit, so they have their premiums offset, and that's based on their income level, and then they pay a portion of their income towards the premiums. And I think I've gotten ahead of myself a little bit. I wanted to also point out on this chart, you might be wondering what that line going across means. So the top of the bar is it's the accumulation of all the benefits and tax credits that you receive, but that line that goes across that I've labeled monthly available income, that represents the money that families actually have in their pockets to meet their monthly expenses. So it takes your earned income. In this case, I've added SNAP, even though it's not technically SNAP or cash. It's similar in families' budgets. And then I deducted things that you have to pay on a monthly basis, like your payroll taxes, your health care premiums, and your child care costs. The important thing is that I've excluded the tax credits that you would only receive in a lump sum at tax time, because families don't have those resources to meet their monthly expenses. So for the single adults in Portland working 18 hours a week, the major impact is the loss of Medicaid at $17 per hour. And then the last thing I'd like to point out on this chart is that these single adults are paying income taxes. So you can see that gray section on the bottom is actually negative. So they are paying those amounts in payroll and income taxes. So this is just like the other chart, except that the single adult is working 30 hours per week. You can see that this person becomes ineligible for Medicaid at a lower wage, so at just $10 an hour, a single adult working 30 hours a week would become ineligible for Medicaid. And also, the single adult working 30 hours a week becomes ineligible for SNAP benefits at $12 an hour. But you can see that the SNAP benefits do gradually decline as the income goes up, so it doesn't contribute to a cliff effect for this individual. So moving on to the one-parent, one-child family working in Portland at 18 hours a week, you can see that this family type does not lose access to any benefits up to $18 per hour at 18 hours a week. But you can see the monthly available income line is below the earned income, the green section, because this family has to pay child care costs. And I believe the Portland child care costs that we've used are about $640 a month.
I'm sorry. Can you explain that again? It totally went over my head. I apologize.
Certainly. So that monthly earned income line represents what families have in their paychecks to make their expenses. So it doesn't include those tax credits you receive in a lump sum, but it also deducts those expenses that you have to pay in order to work. So it deducts child care expenses. So it's below the earned income bars because you're paying for those child expenses. Okay, so still looking at a one-parent, one-child family, but working 30 hours per week. In this scenario, the parent becomes ineligible for Medicaid benefits at $13.15 an hour. The child remains eligible for Medicaid, so just the adult would have to go on the health insurance exchange and purchase that private health insurance plan. Okay, so here's where We add in the employment-related daycare subsidy, so that's that sort of turquoise color there in the middle. So families in this program are required to pay a co-payment towards their child care based on a percentage of their income. And then the Department of Human Services provides the rest as long as it the costs fall below the maximum established rates. So that's why you see that turquoise section gradually declining. And in this analysis, you can see that the employment-related daycare program doesn't contribute to a cliff for this family type, as because they remain eligible across this income scale. And then here we have that same chart, but for Eastern Oregon. So for families who are using the employment-related daycare, and I'd like to point out that that's about 9,000 people across the state are using that program. So it is a small program. So the people in rural Oregon who access this program, their child care costs are lower, but their co-payments are the same as individuals living in Portland because it's based off your income. So the difference really comes in at around $15 an hour because their co-payment starts to equal the total cost of their child care. So they're no longer receiving a subsidy because their co-payment that they're required to pay exceeds the actual cost of the child care expenses. So the previous panel talked about effective marginal tax rate. So this would change that effective marginal tax rate for Eastern Oregon families. It would actually be lower because they're not they're able to meet their full child care expenses and their co-payments aren't increasing.
Members of the committee, this is Eric Warren, the CFO for DHS. Just to add, the topic of employment-related daycare is actually being discussed in the next room as we speak, and the policies along those lines. Partly it's expanding access to daycare services to increase the number of families that are eligible, but a big focus is also on the quality of daycare and increasing the quality of daycare in order to get kids ready to learn as they are entering school through that program.
Okay, so this final chart also looks at a one-parent, one-child family back to Portland now, but it incorporates the TANF benefits. In order to look at the TANF benefits, we had to structure our analysis a little bit differently because the income eligibility is quite a bit lower than the scale that we were using previously. So for this two-person family, you can't make more than in 2014, you couldn't make more than $499 a month to qualify for this program. So this chart shows a family with one parent working at the minimum wage, and then the horizontal axis increases the number of hours, not the wage. So you can see that families receiving TANF, working 0 hours a week, receive the full TANF grant, which is that gold section on the grant on the graph, and then that grant gets smaller as they earn more money because their benefit is reduced by 50 cents for every dollar that they earn. So in this, and then you can see that once they work 14 hours a week at the minimum wage, they become ineligible for TANF, and they lose that benefit, contributing to a decline in their monthly available resources. However, the total amount of resources they receive from the state increases because they are automatically granted. They're enrolled, thank you. They're automatically enrolled in the employment-related daycare program. So they're receiving that employment-related daycare subsidy, but they don't have, and they're paying the co-payment, but they don't have that TANF grant.
And again, for the record, Eric Moore, DHS, the discussions next door are also having, as mentioned earlier, moving to smooth out the reduction of TANF benefits, you know, are also being discussed in the policies next door.
And one final thing I'd just like to add. I think the thing that we were initially focusing on were all of the DHS programs and looking at the SNAP and TANF and ERDC benefits. But where I think we found where individuals receive less benefits or the increase in wages impacts them earliest on is in the receipt of Medicaid for adults only, and that they fall off of Medicaid with a higher level of income, and then have to purchase on the private health insurance exchange. But they are available for the advanced premium tax credit up to a certain percentage of their income. So,
I just have a clarifying question. So, you know, here there is kind of a steady increase, say in the ERDC, up to 12 hours, and then you have sort of a big jump at 14. What explains that shift?
Sure. So when you go from working 12 hours per week and then working 14 hours a week, you go from receiving some money for the TANF grant to being ineligible for that grant. So you your earnings increase slightly, but the major shift is caused by your automatic enrollment into employment-related daycare. So that subsidy is actually more substantial than the TANF grant itself. So you see your total resources increase for that reason.
Thank you. I appreciate your time. We have another panel to get through with only 25 minutes left. I think you've presented a lot of data here and a lot of charts that I think will take me a little time to study, and hopefully you can help us answer questions in the future.
Chair Holby, if I might just say, we have a study that's a draft in narrative that we didn't bring with us that actually synthesizes a lot of this data, but again, it's still in draft form, and so when it's finalized, probably not until after the legislative session is over, in order to get the time to have eyes on the report, we'd be happy to send copies to the committee administrator so she can get it out to the prospective members that are interested in it.
Correct. That would be great.
No, that would be useful. But just, you know, for the sake of today, are there two or three takeaways, you know, from this study that you can point to right now?
Well, I think the biggest takeaway, again, for the record, Eric Moore, is that the drop in benefits is really on the Medicaid side. You have to, between that and just looking at how low the income level is for TANF, you actually have to change the access because to be eligible for TANF, you have to be such a low income level that it really is impacting those with really no income at all. And those are kind of the two major takeaways from
Does
what
the
I
state
see
have any ability to adjust that, or is that all up to the federal government?
No, the state has, again, there's policies being discussed next door right now about those policies. House Bill 3535 is up for discussion that has a goal to help smooth out this orange line so it continues on a little bit further, and to try to help TANF families remain stable once they've found decent employment, again, by also adding employment-related daycare, helps keep them employed and not coming back onto the TANF rolls.
Would raising the minimum wage or just incrementally a little bit be able to enable you to take some benefits and redistribute them to help ease those cliffs as people gain income?
So I wouldn't be able to answer that question directly. What I would say is that the way we've designed these charts are to show what people would make at different levels of income. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you raise the minimum wage and people were making more money, you could see on the chart what would happen to their benefits as we move up the monetary scale.
And then just to close out real quickly again, Tamara Brickman, with respect to the qualification for Medicaid, that's a federal policy level. The federal government decides at what percentage income people remain eligible. So we can't really impact the Medicaid piece from a state perspective.
We could provide a state supplement, couldn't we, to...
That's a question I yeah. can't necessarily ask, but...
Okay, Rip Nose.
Just that we talked about this in the health committee. There's this thing called the basic health plan, and we didn't fund it, I don't think, but it allows under the ACA to allow people up to 185% of the federal poverty level to stay on basically our Oregon health plan. We have to pay for it, but it keeps people on that benefit longer. Mm-hmm. We could do that.
Well, thank you, all three of you.
And
we look forward to the report when it's done, and we'll probably have you back.
Yeah,
thank you for your help.
Thanks.
So our final panel is takes us more directly to the minimum wage, and we have Heather Conroy and Andrea Miller to talk about addressing poverty through an increased minimum wage.
Good morning. So, Chair Dembro, Chair Holvey, the rest of the committee, thank you for having us here this morning. I am Heather Conroy. I'm the Executive Director of SEIU Local 503. Our union represents 55,000 men and women across Oregon who provide services that range from caring for seniors and people with disabilities in community-based care settings, as well as maintaining our state roads, our parks, our forests. Our members serve families across the state, accessing services that we were just hearing about, as well as providing child care in the ERDC program that you also just heard about. So I'd like to start this morning by thanking Speaker Kotek, who I know is not in the room, but thank her for proposing to lift the wage to $13 an hour by 2018 and really lifting preemption. While we continue to believe that a higher minimum wage is appropriate, we think this is a good start to the conversation, and we really think the conversation about lifting preemption is one that we need to have to be able to allow communities to really adjust a wage to meet the needs of the people who live in those communities. So our union, SEIU, is deeply invested in increasing the minimum wage. We believe fundamentally in the dignity of work, and we believe that that means it's something pretty simple, that if you work for a living, you should be able to care for yourself and your family. That's what dignity is about. That's what work is for, is to be able to support yourself. And so in testimony earlier this year, you heard from Nina Johnson, who was here in the spring. She works at Oregon Supported Living Center, which is group homes that care for people with developmental disabilities in the Springfield area. And she shared with you her struggle to make ends meet by working 60 to 80 hours a week so she can support herself and her family. And that's no way to live. We can do better in this state. People deserve to do better. And there's far too many Oregonians, including thousands of members of my union, SEIU, who are working in low-wage jobs that don't pay enough to make a living. And together we can change that, and I think that we need to do that. So minimum wage is an issue about dignity and respect in our values, but it's also an important economic issue. Allowing a low-wage economy to take hold in our state will undermine the quality of life for all of us, and it will put unsustainable demands on the social safety net that we were hearing about earlier today. Strong communities and economies are built when the system works for everyone, not just the top few. When everyone can share in the success of the state economy, we are stronger. And SEIU members see firsthand the impact of a low-wage economy, whether that's through higher caseloads and workloads providing services to families in need, or whether it's just simply as Oregonians and parents who can see day-to-day the struggles in our education system for funding for schools. So while why is increasing the minimum wage important to workers? Our cost of living is an all-time high in Oregon, but wages haven't kept up. The cost of housing, food, and medical expenses has far outpaced wages over the last 50 years. There was a time when minimum wage was actually a wage that you could get by on, you could make ends meet. But now I'm pretty sure that there isn't anybody in this room who believes that you can make ends meet at $12,000 a year.
And we're seeing wages stagnate while not only costs are going up, but corporate profits are at a record high. Increasing corporate profits, don't get me wrong, are a good thing. It's good for the economy. It helps keep the system moving forward. But it's really only good if the people who are working to help create those record profits are sharing in the benefits of those profits, and that those corporations are being contributing to our communities. Otherwise, we're allowing deep inequality to take root and creating an economy that only works for a few. So earlier I mentioned that we believe that in the dignity of work. And I know you heard a report earlier, and it's come up while I was in the room even, in this concept of a self-sufficiency wage. And that's the wage that's really necessary to be independent and not to rely on public services. So self-sufficiency and dignity, in my mind, go hand in hand. And this is where Speaker Kotek's proposal to lift preemption on minimum wage comes into play. First of all, it's important to remember that in the recent decisions in cities up and down the West Coast, from LA to Seattle, SeaTac, Oakland, California, and San Francisco, those decisions to lift their minimum wage in those cities is going to mean that cities up and down the West Coast are very quickly going to outpace wages for many of our own big cities here in Oregon. We've heard a lot of testimony about concerns for smaller rural communities not really being able to sustain a higher minimum wage, and concerns about how there's different labor markets in different parts of the state and cost of living factors being different in different communities. What better way is there to address those differences in realities than lifting preemption to allow local communities to decide for themselves what the appropriate minimum wage is for their area? So earlier this year, an example of that is, you might remember a woman named Cassiel Capriel came in and spoke here. She's a PDX worker. She works at the airport. She does passenger service service support. And part of her testimony, which has stuck with me, and I just think it really demonstrates the differences that we see around the state and the ways in which the cost of surviving and the cost of living is skyrocketing in different parts of our state. She testified in part of her testimony that three different times over the last 2 years, her rent has gone up in her apartment. And each time it's gone up by $100 per month. So her rent's gone up $300 over 2 years. Castile works at the airport. She's worked there for 8 years, and for 8 years she's made minimum wage, with the only raises she has received are the raises because of the indexed minimum wage. So you can just imagine the kind of pressure that that puts on her and her family to see her rent go up by $300 over 2 years. I can tell you her minimum wage didn't go up that much per month over that same time period. So, you know, we see the skyrocketing rents in Portland and a few other communities around the state. But it's not universal, and so really lifting preemption is one way to allow local governments to set local minimum wages that will recognize the needs of their community. But to be clear, though, you missed my slide on the rents. I'm going to skip by that one. So to be clear, though, simply lifting preemption isn't the solution. We have to lift wages as well to ensure that families can provide for themselves. We believe we must do things to support families living in poverty, such as the employment-related daycare, the job training funds, a lot of the programs that we talked about. We're strong advocates for those services. We need that safety net. But that's not enough. Employers have to be a part of the solution. It can't just be government. We need the private sector to help out as well, and employers have to do their part. So I think the private sector can be part of the solution in two very, very specific ways. First, corporate profits are at a record high. We have the 50th lowest corporate tax rate in the country. So profitable corporations, especially those who have built their business model on a low-wage workforce, like McDonald's and Walmart, there's no question that they can certainly afford to contribute more towards building a strong community, whether that's through lifting wages of their workers or paying more in corporate taxes. Earlier this year, I was interested in reading a University of Oregon report that came out that talked about the high cost of low wages. And it was reported in that study that nearly $1.7 billion a year here in Oregon is spent to subsidize employers' low wages through the programs we've been talking about all morning. So we really do need profitable private sector employers to be a part of the solution. They must pay workers enough to make ends meet and help invest in critical services to help those who can't make ends meet. And so you all have the opportunity to move forward for our state and for workers, and to make sure that everyone has a fair shot of getting ahead by lifting wages and allowing local communities to set minimum wages by ending preemption. It's the right thing to do for our economy, and it's the right thing to do for Oregon families, because no one wants to go to work 40 hours a week and have to hold their head low because they're not able to provide for themselves and their families.
She's going to be my clicker.
Okay.
Committee members, Chairs Dimbro, Holvey, thank you for inviting me to come and testify about increasing the minimum wage and for continuing this really important conversation. I'm Andrea Miller, the Executive Director of CAUSA. We're an organization that has advocated with and for Latino families for the past 20 years. CAUSA's members and constituents span Oregon from Redmond, Salem, Hillsboro, Woodburn, Eugene, and more. And we administer a survey every year and ask them, what are the issues that are impacting you on an everyday basis so that we can prioritize our policy priorities? And increasing the minimum wage was among the top three priorities among these Latino families. Actually, it was number two. And it's not, it shouldn't be that surprising that increasing the minimum wage was among these families' greatest needs, given the research on who is making low wages in Oregon. And that's what I wanted to elaborate on today with you. And so beginning with age and education distribution of low-wage workers, according to this research, low-wage workers is defined as $11.59, about two-thirds of the median wage. And as you can see, low-wage workers in Oregon are both older and more educated than any time in the past. Low-wage workers, when you look at 1979, 18% of the low-wage workers were teenagers. By 2014, only 5% were teenagers. The median age here for the low-wage workers is 32 years old. And as you can see through the graph, a sizable portion, 36%, are over the age of 40. So it definitely dispels a lot of the stereotypes about who a minimum wage or low-wage workers is. In addition, 57% had at least some college education, and 15% have a bachelor's degree or higher. So again, not a low-educated community, but rather more education than in the past. Next slide. Low-wage workers are also disproportionately from communities of color. I think that aligns very well with the previous panelists about where we're seeing poverty. When you look at the Latino Hispanic community, 66% of they make up 66% of low-wage workers, and certainly that's across the board with other communities of colors, African American, Asian, etc. There's a huge gap when you look at the white community, and again, that's reflected in our survey of Latino families. 66%, that's pretty high. In addition, it's families that are low-wage workers. So that's the next slide. Who would benefit from a higher minimum wage? Well, that's a lot of women. Half are women, and one-third have children, and over half are single parents. We're talking about families, communities of color, women, and certainly the next slide, people in rural areas, again, very aligned with the poverty statistics. Low-wage jobs exist primarily in high concentrations in rural areas, which is why it's so important that we look at a statewide solution for this. So those are a quick sketch of exactly who are low-wage workers in our state. And at the same time, when we look at job growth, most of the fastest-growing jobs in Oregon, that's the next slide, require little education and pay low wages. According to the Oregon State Employment Department, of the 653,000 job openings expected between 2012 and 2022, only 216,000 have some post-secondary education as a level most workers need to enter an occupation. The remaining openings, 437,000, have high school education or less as the typical education level needed. And this suggests that economic growth alone will not address the problem. it's not just about recruiting new jobs to rural areas and the state. The reality is that the jobs that are being created require low education and pay and low wages, like caregiving, retail, food prep. These jobs are needed in our communities, services that people can rely on, and they often pay minimum wage or just slightly above that. And of course, you know, this is not unique to Oregon, but nationwide. And if we want to have new jobs, we should make good jobs, people, you know, jobs that people can actually live on. And we believe that increasing the minimum wage is one solution towards that. And, you know, that's all the slides. Yeah. There's a lot of statistics out there, and we've seen a lot of information. Really, that makes my head boggle at sometimes. But we all know that these statistics are lived out by real people in our communities. And I just want to highlight one, Gustavo, who lives in Bend. He was very vocal, been a vocal advocate for both paid sick days and the minimum wage, because he'd be directly impacted. He lives in Bend. He's in his mid-20s. He's the head of his household. He has four siblings to take care of. He has a high school education, but wants to get more. He wants to go to community college, Bend Community College. But unfortunately, he works 75 to 80 hours a week, which makes it really tough for him to get to those college classes. He works at two minimum wage jobs, at a restaurant, at a pizza joint in Bend, and at a grocery store. And those are just to cover the bills of his household. Again, he's got four siblings. I mean, could you imagine a world where he could just have one job and then go to community college, get his education, and then earn a higher wage? I think that would be the ideal. But in the meantime, he's kind of stuck in this cycle, and the minimum wage increasing it would really help folks like him have just one job instead of having to work two. And Gustavo's story, like hundreds of people across the state, as Heather has said, is why we need to raise the minimum wage. So I'll end there, and we'll open it to questions. I know we're short in time, and just again, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you, both of you. Yes, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick, I kind of hit on these questions a little earlier on one of the issues I have with minimum wage, because we want everybody to make more. So I actually worked three jobs when I was going to school at different times just to pay for things and get by. But when we increase the minimum wage, we see the cost of goods go up across the board. We have a huge population in Oregon that's on a fixed income. Our senior citizens, they can't adjust for this. When you're younger, you can go out and get it. But when you're a senior citizen, I mean, Walmart only hires so many greeters. What do they do? How are they going to afford this when we drive up the cost of, I just ran the numbers from what we had in an earlier presentation, like their food costs going from $721 a month to $973 mm-hmm. for a family of four. Those costs go up across the board. We already have the second highest cost of living, or one of the highest cost of living in the nation. This isn't going to help drive that down.
Okay, let's let them address that.
Can you take that? So I think there's lots of studies out there that show that increasing in the minimum wage actually does have a negligible impact on the cost of goods. And I can just tell you from personal experience, I worked as a waitress for many years. And when minimum wage went up, we did not see huge increases in the cost of the food that we were serving and huge increases into the prices of what we were charging the customers. I think what we have to look back at is the slide that we had up that shows that there's corporate profits out there. And when you think about who some of the biggest employers are of minimum wage workers, they are some of the companies that do have some of the biggest profits. When you look at the Walmarts, when you look at the McDonald's, when you look at the Burger King, and I think it's incumbent upon those companies to be paying their workers out of those profits rather than looking to consumers. There's a tipping point, right? And so I mean, I appreciate your concern for people on fixed incomes. I think we all have those concerns, but the reality is there's money in our economic system to sustain these wages.
Let's go to Rep. Barreto.
No, thank you, yes. Mr. Chair. I think it was Amanda, you said we need to make more good jobs. How do you do that?
Referring to me?
No.
I'm sorry, I'm Heather.
I'm sorry, Amanda.
Heather. This is
Andrea.
Andrea, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, so, you know, the main proposal, the way our definition of good jobs are jobs that people can live on, so increasing the minimum. So there's already jobs being created, right? We want those jobs to be jobs that people can actually pay their bills on. And so our definition is having a larger wage.
But how do you create those jobs? How are they made?
I can't answer that question. I'm not a business person or business owner.
So I appreciate the information you're giving us. I think it does highlight some of the issues we're facing. I think the graph you got from the U.S. Department of Labor from the Federal Reserve Bank that does show the corporate profits, which I think when there are corporate profits, you know, there's potential investments into new business, which will help create jobs. You know, I think that's Representative Barreto was kind of going that way, that is it does take some of those corporate profits to do that. But at the same time, it's very telling to see the wages basically are flatlined from the 1960s, regardless of the economic growth that you see based on the corporate profits. And so to help people, that either we need to raise that line to more reflect on wages, to more reflect the growth, the economic growth, or the taxes have to be raised to subsidize people who can't make ends meet because they don't have that living wage. And I think that's a fundamental piece that it is driving this discussion about raising the minimum wage and trying to fundamental also driving the need for more investments in education, more investments in ERDC and TANF and all these other programs. But that, of course, can't be done without raising the revenue to do it. So I appreciate this. I hope that you're able to stay engaged with us as we continue talking about the minimum wage.
I will just add to that you know, with respect to corporate profits, you know, of course there are businesses and there are businesses, right? And one thing, you know, something that a number of jurisdictions that are looking at raising their minimum wage have done is have the minimum wage go up at different rates for small businesses versus large businesses. So they're kind of phasing them in and, you know, focusing the initial work on the very largest employers and then having the small businesses rising at a slower rate. That certainly is something that we need to look at, as we're looking at if we are going to raise the minimum wage, you know, at what rate overall, you know, what speed do we phase it in, but also do we differentiate regionally, do we differentiate by employer size, et cetera, et cetera.
I'd just like to comment one on Representative Widener's concern about the rising costs. I think that is a concern, I think, that also needs to be looked at. You know, the raising costs on fixed income people, I mean, I think it sort of calls out that we need to look at our tax structure a little bit and perhaps provide more relief if, in fact, those raise or, you know, elements of economic growth and rising wages has that impact on fixed income, that we need to adjust for that in our tax structure probably to make sure we take that bite away from the seniors with some added tax relief or programs that help the fixed income community.
To respond to that, to one of the other points I was getting at, too.
Actually, I think we're going to have to wrap this up.
Yeah.
30 seconds?
Sorry. 10 o'clock.
Just one of the things that I think we really need to look at closely, too, is that we're not driving everybody's wage scale down because you move this side up, because lots of times that's a training wage coming into and you have people making more in a company. Well, a company just looks at, I have 30% that I allocate to salaries, so how do I normalize that? So you might see your middle class actually gets pinched and hurt the worst on this, and we just drove down the family incomes because of the training wage incomes coming in. So these are things that need to be considered.
Heather, you had a final comment?
I was just going to, what you were saying around the fixed income is that the reality is these are all policy decisions, right? And we can make decisions as a state as to how we adjust, whether it's a benefits cliff or a fixed income situation. And if more people are prospering in our economy, it will be easier to make those decisions.
Thank you. I appreciate everybody's attention and participation and the questions from the legislators here. Thank you very much for coming.
those of you out there won't appreciate just how unusual it is to have this level of engagement this late in the session. I think this is something we are really engaged with and will continue to be. So thank you very much.
Our work group
will start its work next week, and we will keep you all informed on how that's going. We'll certainly have follow-up during the September legislative hearings, so stay tuned.
Thank you.
And with that, I'll close the Senate hearing for today.
And I'll adjourn the House Business and Labor Committee. Thank you. Thank you.